Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 4,601. Ector County negative, 21,663 out of 26,673 tested, with 409 pending, 92 deaths. Recovered, 3,925. Active, 584. Midland County, 3,528 confirmed cases with 81 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, 3,081 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 20th, 238 less than a week ago. They occupy 5.3% of hospital beds. 2,241 new cases were reported on September 20th. The latest positivity rate is 6.77%. 14,893 Texans have died as of September 20th. 45 more deaths reported than a day before, and 703 more than a week ago. And today, West Texas Intermediate trading at $39.27. That's down $1.84. First, we'll read you some coronavirus briefs and short stories. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has acknowledged officially what many medical experts have long argued. The novel coronavirus often spreads through aerosols. Updated guidance on the agency's website states that the virus most commonly spreads when people come in close contact and such particles are inhaled in the nose, mouth, airways, and lungs. The global tally of people who have died from the coronavirus is rapidly approaching 1 million, while the United States will soon reach 200,000 fatalities. At least 30.9 million cases have been reported worldwide, with the United States contributing more than 6.7 million infections to that count. More than 6 months into the pandemic in the U.S., the shortage of N95 masks persists, leaving healthcare workers exposed and health experts flummoxed. Why is the world's richest country still struggling to meet the demand for an item that costs around $1 apiece? Representative Johanna Hayes, Democrat, Connecticut, said Sunday that she tested positive for the coronavirus after visiting three facilities in an attempt to get a diagnosis. Her experience underscores the need for a national testing strategy with a coherent way to receive speedy, accurate results, she wrote on Twitter. This level of anxiety and uncertainty is untenable. Nearly 11,000 people have been exposed to the coronavirus on flights, according to the CDC. But because of incomplete contact tracing information, the agency has not been able to confirm any cases where transmission occurred. More than 4,500 students, teachers, and staff at Texas schools have tested positive for the coronavirus since the school year began, according to the Dallas Morning News. Tofu sales skyrocket during the pandemic as consumers search for affordable meat alternatives. As people in Oregon tried to avoid wildfires, coronavirus cases spiked, officials say. Now to some short articles. There's an unmistakable spike in new infections. Former FDA commissioner says. There is an unmistakable spike in new COVID-19 infections in the U.S., which is concerning as the country heads into fall and winter. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, said on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday. "Well, I think we have at least one more cycle with this virus heading into the fall and winter," Gottlieb said. "If you look at what's happening around the country right now, there's an unmistakable spike in new infections." Gottlieb also said the declines in hospitalizations that have been seen over the summer are starting to level off and that he would expect them to start going up again. "There are about 15 states," he said, "that have a positivity rate of 10% or higher, which is deeply concerning, and about 30 states where the R rate, or rate of transfer, is above 1, meaning they have an expanding epidemic. It is unclear whether this resurgence of infection is a post-Labor Day bump that will start to level off or the beginning of a resurgence heading into fall and winter," he said. but I'm deeply concerned that as we head into the fall and the winter, this is the season when a respiratory pathogen like coronavirus wants to spread. And so there's a lot of risk heading into this season. Complacency, a real setup for risk. Gottlieb said another concern is that as people start to get a little more complacent due to exhaustion from what the population has been going through and start going back to school, college, and work against the backdrop of fall and winter when people start going inside more due to the weather, that's a real setup for risk, he said. Pine Sol approved as effective cleaner against coronavirus spread. The latest cleaning product to receive federal approval as an effective disinfectant against the virus that causes COVID-19 may already be in your cabinet. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency approved Pine Sol Original Multi-Surface Cleaner for effectively killing SARS-CoV-2 on hard, non-porous surfaces after lab testing, the product's maker, The Clorox Company, announced in a news release. Pine Sol Original Multi-Surface Cleaner now offers the clean families have trusted through generations with the protection they need right now against the spread of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. Chris Hyder, Clorox's vice president and general manager of cleaning, said in the release, "We hope this new Pine Sol kill claim will increase access to disinfectants that can help prevent the spread of COVID-19," Hyder said. The product, which features the active ingredient glycolic acid, is listed under TUC 3 on the EPA's list of approved disinfectants. Assisted living facilities and nursing homes with higher numbers of minority residents are more likely to have more COVID-19 cases, research finds. Nursing homes and assisted living facilities with higher proportions of minority residents are more likely to have more COVID-19 cases, according to two new studies published Monday in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society. The first, from the University of Rochester Medical Center, looked at 12,576 nursing homes that passed the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Quality Assurance Check for submitted data and reported to CMS's Nursing Home COVID-19 Public File for the week ending May 31st. Nursing homes caring for disproportionately more racial and ethnic minority residents tended to have more COVID-19 confirmed cases among their residents and staff, and more new COVID-19-related deaths among residents. Yu Li and colleagues from the Department of Public Health Sciences, Division of Health Policy and Outcomes, research said. Predicted counts of cases and deaths per facility were 2 to 4 times as high in nursing homes that had the highest proportions of racial ethnic minority residents compared to those with low proportions. The second study, from the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry, looked at data on confirmed COVID-19 cases and deaths through May 29th from 3,994 assisted living facilities, with 2,542 cases and 675 deaths in 7 states. As in nursing homes, Alabama assisted living communities with a higher proportion of minority residents tend to have a higher count of COVID-19 cases, Helena Temkin-Greener and colleagues from the Department of Public Health Sciences wrote. They found that assisted living facilities with higher proportions of Black and Hispanic residents had more COVID-19 cases, as did communities with higher proportions of residents with dementia, COPD, and obesity, and a higher proportion of men. Assisted living facilities had a case fatality rate that was 4 times higher than the average across the 7 states included in the study, even though fewer than 10% of them reported being affected by the pandemic. They also found that larger assisted living facilities appeared to be more likely to experience at least one COVID-19 case, but they are not necessarily more likely to experience a greater number of cases. Related to that report, here's an article from the Associated Press published from the Austin American-Statesman. Much needs doing to shield nursing homes from virus. By Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar, the Associated Press, published September 17th, Washington. The Trump administration is claiming resounding vindication from an independent commission's report on the coronavirus crisis in nursing homes. But some panel members say that's a misinterpretation of their conclusion and that much remains to be done to safeguard vulnerable residents. People in long-term care facilities represent less than 1% of the U.S. population, but more than 40% of the coronavirus deaths, according to the COVID-19 Tracking Project, which has tallied 77,000 deaths among residents and staff. Those harsh numbers are a sensitive political issue for President Donald Trump, who is trying to hang on to support from older voters. Vice President Mike Pence met with some of the commission members Thursday and called their report a significant contribution to our ongoing effort to ensure the health and well-being of our seniors in nursing homes and long-term care facilities around the country. The commission was set up by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS. Agency Administrator Seema Verma called its findings an invaluable action plan for the future and a resounding vindication of our overall approach to date. But with 27 major recommendations in the commission's report, it's not time for officials to take a bow, several members noted. There's an enormous to-do list in front of us, said Terry Fulmer, a commission member and president of the John A. Hatford Foundation, which works to improve care for older adults. The administration says it has already acted or made progress on most issues flagged. It hasn't gone far enough, says Fulmer. We need to get the real data that will tell us where we're still lacking testing, protective equipment, and appropriate staffing, she said. We need to really watch the autumn flu season and really keep a close eye on any uptick with the virus. That's what I'm most worried about. We don't have a national policy that we are following so we can ensure we have quality across our entire nation. So we're looking for progress there. Harvard professor David Grabowski, another member, said there's a sense of mission accomplished coming from the administration, and that's just not the case. We were charged with providing a roadmap out of the crisis, Grabowski said. We weren't asked to evaluate the CMS response or provide any kind of evaluation as to how they have handled the pandemic. Among the top recommendations in the 186-page report, establish a national testing strategy. After a stumbling start in which the White House tried to delegate testing in nursing homes to the states, the administration has been shipping fast test machines to facilities, but there's concern about ongoing supplies, staff training, and other issues. Guarantee supplies of PPE, or personal protective equipment. Earlier this summer, as COVID-19 rebounded across the South and West, one in five nursing homes faced PPE shortages. The commission called on the government to take responsibility, guaranteeing a three-month supply of high-quality gear for facilities. The administration says it has provided money for PPE and in August began shipping N95 masks to nursing homes that reported shortages. Safely resume family visits. Nursing homes have been in lockdown since mid-March, and that has taken a toll on the well-being of residents. Some facilities have started to allow visits again. The commission recommended a detailed template for how nursing homes can safely resume visitation. The administration says it has already provided guidance. More help with infection control. Moving residents within a facility to separate those infected with COVID-19 is one of the main ways to contain outbreaks, but that can involve added costs and challenges. The commission said clearer government guidance is needed. The ravages of the coronavirus in nursing homes have surprised and shocked many people. Experts such as Grabowski say their research indicates the virus gets into facilities from the surrounding communities, unwittingly carried by staff and visitors who may not yet have symptoms. The commission concluded that the pandemic has exposed basic flaws in the nation's oversight of nursing homes, which divides responsibilities among federal, state, and local authorities. That resulted in a patchwork approach to infection prevention and control, that many believe has contributed to our nation's inability to contain the spread of the virus, the report said. University of Chicago professor Tamara Conseca, an expert on long-term care who reviewed the commission's report, said the recommendations follow the growing consensus over the past 6 months about what needs to be done to stem the cases and deaths in nursing homes. But she also took issue with the administration's claims it has met the moment. I would classify the CMS actions to date as a move in the right direction and better late than never, she said. But as we get close to 80,000 nursing home deaths and counting, it's difficult to think of the federal response as unprecedented and successful. Now here's an article from the Washington Post. You're not imagining it. Masks can make your eyes feel dry. Here's what to do. Mask-associated dry eye is an emerging phenomenon, but experts say the condition is easily managed and should not be a reason to stop wearing face coverings. By Allison Chu. When the elderly man came in to see Ohio-based ophthalmologist Daryl White in early May, complaining of a burning sensation in his eyes and occasional blurry vision, White knew exactly what he was dealing with, another case of dry eye syndrome. What didn't entirely make sense, though, was that White, a dry eye expert, has been caring for the man for 20 years, and not once had his patient shown any symptoms of the common condition. Then, as White looked at the man, who was wearing a face mask, a familiar pandemic-era accessory, he was hit with a light bulb moment. With each breath, his glasses were fogging and unfogging. Fogging and unfogging, White says. That was the aha moment for me. The man's steamed-up glasses and his sudden onset of eye dryness are both signs of what White is calling mask-associated dry eye, or MAID, an emerging phenomenon amid the coronavirus pandemic that eye experts are now urging the public to be mindful about. The real reason for bringing this to people's attention is to say, hey, if you notice this, this is why it's happening, and let's help you manage your dry eye while you continue to wear your mask, says Lyndon Jones, director of the University of Waterloo's Center for Ocular Research and Education in Canada. We would hate for people to use this as an excuse to not wear their masks. Dry eye can cause discomfort, blurred vision, and redness, among other symptoms. Between 20 and 25% of people worldwide report dry eye at some point in their lives, and the problem is more likely as we age. But in recent months, some eye care providers have reported an uptick in patients, both who wear glasses and those who don't, wondering why their eyes feel drier than usual, especially while wearing masks. Eye dryness associated with face coverings, which has been the subject of at least one published paper in recent months, is probably triggered by air expelled from breathing going out the top of the mask and flowing over the surface of your eyes, according to eye experts we spoke with. The moving air dries out the tear film, a thin layer of fluid covering the eye surface, and speeds up evaporation. It is also possible, White says, that the mask may be aggravating oil glands near the eye and causing inflammation, which can lead to tears evaporating more rapidly. He noted, however, that the potential link between mask wearing and oil gland inflammation is not really very well understood, leading experts to consider airflow a more probable cause. White described mask associated dry eye as an accelerant for symptoms, particularly in people who either already have the condition or have a higher chance of developing it. One such at-risk group would be people who spend a lot of time staring at screens, White says. For instance, those of us who have now been working from home for months. So many of us now attend a gazillion Zoom meetings a day, said Thomas Steineman, a clinical spokesman for the American Academy of Ophthalmology. If not that, we're working on projects that require our intense scrutiny staring at a screen. Research has shown that when people look at screens, they blink less often or fail to blink completely, resulting in dry or irritated eyes. You add a little bit of occupational hazard at the computer and a mask on top of that when you're not at the computer, and yeah, your eyes probably feel pretty crummy, Steinemann said. But that uncomfortable feeling is easily avoidable, experts say. Here's what they recommend. Find a mask that fits properly. An ill-fitting or poorly made face covering will increase the chances that exhaled air escapes from the top of the mask, says Surendra Basti, a professor of ophthalmology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Ideally, a mask should have a metal strip at the top incorporated in the mask so that you can push it and it takes the contour of your nose and cheekbones, Basti says. That way, the top edge of the mask sits flush with your face and more effectively blocks airflow. Proactively take care of dry eye symptoms. We often end up ignoring the discomfort or blurred vision until our eyes are screaming at us, Steinemann says. Instead, it's important to pay attention to how your eyes are feeling and be committed to treating the symptoms. One common way to alleviate dryness is a simple method Steinemann calls 20-20-20. Every 20 minutes for 20 seconds, just 20 seconds, give yourself a break and look 20 feet away from the computer, he says. For mask-related dryness, Steinemann says briefly taking off the covering is another option as long as you are alone or it is otherwise safe to do so. Over-the-counter artificial tear drops are also effective, Basti says. Eye drops without preservatives, which can irritate the eye, are preferable, he says. Those drops should not be confused with redness relievers, which eye experts do not recommend, Steinemann says. When you put it on the eye, the vessels will shrink, but then the pharmacologic effect wears off, he says, resulting in a rebound effect that can cause real swollen blood vessels on the white of the eye. Fight the urge to rub your eyes. Although the novel coronavirus has made face touching a universal no-no, eye doctors have long been discouraging people from touching their eyes. The temptation is to close your eyes and rub them, and 99.9% of the time, that turns out to be a super bad idea, White says. Eye rubbing can lead to a host of problems, including microabrasions in the cornea and inflammation that make your eye more swollen, he says. Hopefully, the possibility of getting COVID will make people do all the right things by not touching their eyes, he says. Not touching your eyes is good policy every day of the week, every week of the year, every year. Keep wearing your mask. Eye dryness, although annoying, is not going to pose serious issues for most people, Jones says. So don't stop wearing your mask out of concern that it might make your eyes feel dry. I wouldn't want people to think, oh my goodness, I can't wear my mask because it's going to produce this terrible situation, he says. That's blowing it way out of proportion. The benefits of mask wearing outweigh the eye discomfort, Basti says. The mask serves many purposes which are much bigger than the eye symptoms, he says, noting that the various ways to manage dry eye are better than just going without a mask. At least they don't put other people at risk, he says. Now we're going to go into our pre-recorded reports that we have for you today, and we'll start with three reports that are from the Texas Standard. This first is state officials walk back planned cuts to health programs for vulnerable Texans.
Joining me now is Alex Samuels, reporter for the Texas Tribune. Hey, Alex, good to talk to you again.
Yes, always happy to be back.
Massive reversal I want to talk about regarding a proposal to cut $15 million to women's and children health services. Can you talk about the latest?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, on Tuesday, state health officials walked back a plan to cut $15 million in funding from health and safety net programs, including services that offer low-income Texans access to birth control and cancer screenings and support young families of young children with disabilities or developmental delays. The walking back came after lawmakers and advocates warned that not doing this would hurt vulnerable Texans, and they criticized top state officials for propelling this process without formal input from the legislature.
So they're walking back after a lot of protest. And there's another one that is very interesting, a ruling this week by the Texas Supreme Court that involves Green Party candidates. Can you tell me what happened there?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of back and forth on this issue. Last month, a state appeals court sided with Texas Democrats who were asking to kick three Green Party candidates off the ballot because they had not paid their filing fees.
Oh.
Then the Texas Green Party appealed the decision to the state Supreme Court, which ruled on Tuesday that the Secretary of State needed to ensure that these Green Party candidates appear on the November ballot. So this latest ruling will lead to a bit of a scramble at county election offices.
Wow.
Because
mm-hmm.
they have to now update their overseas and military ballots by Saturday mailing deadline and send new corrected ballots to replace any that had already been mailed.
Oh, goodness. And also, let's talk about your latest story for the Texas Tribune. That's another good one. You wrote about voter registration in Texas. It has gone down during the pandemic. And,
yeah.
you know, I mean, I've been nudging people. My brother-in-law recently moved to Texas, and he travels a lot, so I called him. But why is the voter registration going down?
So a big reason why voter registrations plummeted over the spring was because of the pandemic. Of
mm-hmm.
course, the closure of driver's license offices
uh-huh.
played a major role in this decrease. And Texas also doesn't allow people to register to vote when they renew their licenses online. So that's been a big part because there's no online voter registration and groups aren't going out in the public square to register Texans. It's a lot harder to register to vote for this upcoming election.
So what should we tell listeners? How can they register? Can they still register? Are there deadlines?
They can still register. The deadline is October 5th. You know, Texas began the process of gradually reopening the driver's license offices in May. And Texas is also part of the Electronic Registration Information Center. And participation in this program requires that Texas officials identify and conduct research to eligible but unregistered voters and encourage them to register to vote.
Alex Samuels is political reporter for the Texas Tribune, and you can read all about it over at texastribune.org. Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you. You too.
Governor Abbott relaxed limits on restaurants and retail, as well as gyms, but kept bars closed. Here's more in this report.
Remember, it was the beginning of spring when the state shutdown started? No one would have predicted we would be at the doorway of fall, still in crisis, but trying to find the pathway back into normalcy. Texas Governor Greg Abbott addressed the state yesterday with lots of news for reopenings. Some are big news, like how the state plans to measure progress. Some are, let's say, baby steps. Speaking of baby steps, I can see some babies visiting grandparents starting next week. As the governor said, nursing homes can start having visitors again as of Thursday, but with no direct contact. Loved ones will be blowing kisses through plexiglass. And let's get some more details about the governor's announcements with Nicole Cobbler. She is a state politics reporter for the Austin American Statesman, and she joins us now. Nicole, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this press conference. Governor Abbott said he would be further reopening business operations in the state, but there are some things that we need to talk about. By how much and which businesses does this apply to?
Yeah, he announced yesterday that businesses that are currently at 50% capacity could move to 75%,
okay.
which includes gyms, manufacturers, retailers, restaurants. There's a few others, but bars would remain closed.
What's the story with bars?
Yeah.
I mean, when we talk to bar owners, they're like, you know, we're very similar to other businesses.
Right. Yeah. I was sort of on the edge of my seat too about whether, you know, he would move to reopen bars because he's gotten a lot of pressure, like you said, from those businesses and some members of his own party. But he said yesterday that he's just concerned that these are still high spread areas for the coronavirus. And basically, he needs to figure out ways that these businesses can be open safely.
Can you tell me where the state stands when it comes to the state of coronavirus outbreaks? I think that's one of the things that has been a little bit confusing. What is influencing Governor Abbott when he allows more businesses to reopen?
Yeah, a big part of it, he said yesterday, is that hospitalizations will now be a key metric. And that I think is kind of a shift from what he's previously said while determining reopenings. Of course, hospitalizations have always been an important factor for him. But yesterday he said that he's going to look at, in each of the state's hospital regions, he's going to analyze, how many coronavirus patients, what percentage are in hospitals in that region. So if it's over 15%.
Because it used to be positivity rates, metric.
That was a big one for him, right? He always mentioned, like, if the statewide positivity rate was over 10%, that would be reason to close down, basically. And the positivity rate, the measure for how the state health department is tracking it has changed.
Did the governor say why he was using hospitalization rates instead of positivity rates?
Well, he really did not talk about positivity rates at all yesterday, which I think was much different from his previous press conferences.
Yeah.
But he just said that, hospitalizations, he now feels like really can show you how much the coronavirus is spreading in an area. He said he will also look at other important factors, but didn't really hone in on what exactly those would be.
One challenge, though, is we're constantly talking about hospital closures in some regions. So the places that don't have hospitals, that will be hard to measure. I wanted to ask you about some of the fumbles with the data reporting throughout the pandemic. Do you think the two are connected, that there's been some fumbling and that now we're going to be looking at hospitalization rates instead of positivity rates?
I definitely had that question at the front of my mind. The governor's office has not answered me on that. But, it is interesting that on Monday, DSHS is coming out with this change in how it tracks the positivity rate. And that change, which they say now they have a more accurate figure, but it does show that the positivity rate was actually much higher than we thought when we went through reopenings, back in May and June. And, that has to sort of be on Abbott's mind as well, is that this positivity rate has changed. Data has changed a lot, mm-hmm. and it seems like hospitalizations are where we can really get an accurate picture of how many COVID patients are in hospitals around the state.
And I guess another interesting thing that we have to mention is that it's not a statewide reopening to 75%.
Yes. So he said that in three hospital regions in the state, Victoria, Laredo, in both of those areas, and the Rio Grande Valley, that those three areas do not qualify right now. They don't meet those hospitalization standards, mm-hmm. Meaning that coronavirus patients exceed 15% of all hospitalizations. He did say that if that changed, that he'd reverse course and those places would be able to expand capacity and that kind of thing.
We've been speaking with Nicole Kobler. She is a state politics reporter for the Austin American Statesman. Thank you so much, Nicole, for joining me.
Thanks so much. Good to talk to you.
As we go into another week without a federal stimulus package, John Cornyn says unprecedented pandemic requires more relief spending, but that Democratic proposals go too far.
John Cornyn has been in his current office since 2002, and many believe he's in the toughest race of his political career this year, facing Democratic challenger MJ Hager. Yesterday, when we spoke with him, he just returned to D.C. from Austin as lawmakers were taking up an issue critical to many Texans right now, relief to help weather the pandemic. Many lives and livelihoods have been put on hold by shutdowns and social distancing requirements, and initial assistance from the federal government has dried up in many quarters. Now the senior senator from Texas is among the Republicans trying to push through another aid package, one that many Democrats are not on board with, as it's considerably more modest than their own proposal. Senator John Cornyn of Texas, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Great to be with you.
Well, U.S. senators back from their summer recess this week, and we've been hearing about divisions between parties holding up the passing of another major coronavirus aid package. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was announcing that Republicans in the Senate, including yourself, will vote to advance an emergency stimulus plan. What does that plan include?
Well, this will include what I would call the bipartisan consensus items that were previously a part of the Republican offer, which was called the HEALS Act. As you know, that was about $1 trillion worth of additional spending. And the Speaker Pelosi and House Democrats had countered that with a $3 trillion additional spending bill called the HEROES Act. But that's on top of the $3 trillion we've already spent through four different pieces of legislation, culminating in the CARES Act in late March. But I think there's still work that needs to be done.
Is your objection to the Democrats' plan that it's too expensive?
It is that it includes a lot of non-COVID-related issues. For example, it includes a tax cut for some of the wealthiest people in large blue states like New York and California. And it also includes a variety of different things to support the cannabis industry. And just it's really a grab bag of a lot of different unrelated things. What we need to do is recognize that we're in a two-front war. One is the public health battle, and the other is an economic recession caused by the mitigation efforts. And I think we need to focus on those things and leave these other issues for a later fight on another day.
You know, I think everyday Texans are concerned about how they're going to pay their next month's rent or their mortgage. What about that $600 a week unemployment benefit? Is that going to be reinstated in the Republican plan?
Well, we're going to pay out another direct payment to individuals through no fault of their own, as you point out, or out of work or working reduced hours. And then there will be a reinstatement of the unemployment insurance supplement. The exact amount is not the subject of an agreement, but under the president's executive order now, it's an additional $300 a week. There were some people receiving actually more money not working than to work, which is not obviously our intention to incentivize people to stay away from work if they can safely return, but merely to replace their lost wages. So that's something we still have to work out.
Well, now, the August jobs report shows unemployment rate falling below 10% for the first time since the nation went on lockdown. But the Washington Post is reporting just over half of the 22 million total jobs lost between February and April have not returned. What does a Senate Republican measure do to address that consideration? Because that's a serious figure there.
Well, it is, and it's not going to change until we are able to navigate this virus and to get on with our lives safely. And we're seeing this playing out right now with kids going back to school, college students returning to college. But I think we've learned a lot of lessons. The vaccine is probably not going to be here until the latter part of the year or the beginning of next year. So what we all need to do is take personal responsibility, which is to wash your hands, wear masks, socially distance, and stay home when you're sick. And what we've seen is that actually has a pretty impressive impact in terms of bringing down the spreading of the virus. But that's going to be the formula until we can get that vaccine. I know Governor Abbott and others are looking at what else we can do to reopen to hopefully get people back to work and help grow our economy, because we can't sustain this situation forever where millions of Americans are out of work.
Let me ask you something, Senator. This administration as a whole, how do you think the overall response has been to the COVID crisis? And what are you telling Texans as you're campaigning, Texans who are out of a job or worried about the kids going back to school?
Well, this pandemic is something that nobody saw coming. And it's created an unprecedented experience. And it's been dramatic and it's been painful. And I really feel particularly for people who are out of work and not receiving any income. Because of the mitigation efforts. And that's why I voted for $3 trillion worth of emergency spending, something I would never do except under circumstances like this. But we didn't know how long this was going to last. We had hoped that we'd be in better shape than we are right now. We are starting to see some encouraging numbers coming from the efforts that we're all undertaking. As I said, each of us have a personal role we can play in slowing down and hopefully slowing down that spread. But I think, you know, there's always room for criticism and finger pointing. I don't really find that very constructive at this point. I think people have by and large done the best they could under very difficult and unprecedented circumstances.
Obviously, I mentioned you're running for re-election. Do you plan on campaigning with President Trump in the coming weeks?
I have not spent any time campaigning at all. I've been, virtually none. I am spending time traveling around the state, going to high schools and colleges and listening to the county judges and mayors and others tell me how what we have done, how that has met their need and where more needs to be done. The Save Our Stages Act is just one example of that, the work we're trying to do to help restaurants be available to reopen once the government officials allow it. That's been where my focus is. This is the strangest re-election that I've ever been through because it involves very little campaigning. It's basically doing the job I've already been elected to do.
Let me ask you one other thing, and I know you've been involved in politics long enough to remember back in the day when Republicans were really concerned about the budget deficit and about whether we'd ever be able to pay back what we owed. And I noticed just the other day that we crossed a new threshold that we haven't since World War II. We're now, our debt is now greater than our gross domestic product. That's historic. We ever going to be able to pay this back?
Well, we don't have any choice. It is very distressing, to be sure, but I view this as sort of a domestic equivalent to World War II when we were trying to defeat Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, which was an existential threat to our country and to the rest of the world. We didn't worry about deficits and debt, but you're absolutely right that this is not going away. This is not monopoly money. And the historic efforts that we've undertaken to try to keep the economy afloat and try to deal with the public health crisis has run up a huge tab. But now, after we get this under control, we need to turn on a bipartisan basis to addressing that debt and those deficits. No doubt about it.
You've been generous with your time, Senator. I just have one follow-up on that, because you are noting that we are in a time similar to what we faced during the last World War. Given those exigencies, sir, you look at the Democrats' plan, they want to spend $2 trillion more than the Republicans do. Why not, if we're at a time of war?
Well, I don't want to spend money giving millionaires and billionaires a tax cut. They want to reverse what we put in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which capped the deductibility of state and local taxes. And as you know, some of these places like New York and San Francisco, they have much, much higher taxes than we have in Texas. So basically what happens is you have Texans subsidizing millionaires and billionaires in places like San Francisco and New York. I just don't think that's fair. And so I'm not willing to go there.
Republican U.S. Senator John Cornyn is running for re-election in November. Senator Cornyn, thanks again for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much.
Now moving to the Texas Tribune, we have two columns from Ross Ramsey. The first analysis is Texas reopenings tied more to COVID-19 severity than to spread. And the next is COVID-19's almost incomprehensible toll in Texas.
This is Ross Ramsey from the Texas Tribune. Today's column, Texas reopenings tied more to COVID-19 severity than to spread. If you want to know what's happening with business reopenings during the pandemic in Texas, watch your local hospital. Governor Greg Abbott said Thursday that COVID-19 hospitalizations are the most important numbers in his decision-making about how many people to allow in restaurants and other businesses in the state. He made the announcement a few days after the state's health department rejiggered its calculations of positivity rates, a measure of how many people tested for COVID-19 are infected, and the governor's old favorite metric. Instead of concentrating on the spread of the virus, the state is now concentrating on the severity of the spread. It's not primarily about how many Texans are infected, but about how many of them get sick enough to go to the hospital. As long as that COVID-19 hospitalization rate, the percentage of occupied hospital beds that are occupied by coronavirus patients, remains below 15% for at least 7 days in a row, the governor said Thursday, businesses dependent on crowds can admit more customers. That excludes only three of the state's trauma service areas, Laredo, Rio Grande Valley, and Victoria, which means that most of the state's businesses will be on longer leashes starting Monday. What businesses? The governor specified restaurants, retail stores, office buildings, manufacturing facilities, gyms and exercise facilities, museums, and libraries. Elective surgeries were reauthorized. Bars, which remain closed unless they've transformed themselves into restaurants, didn't make the cut. Texas schools and colleges remain as they were, most operating a mix of virtual and in-person classes. Whether and how much those reopenings have sped the spread of the coronavirus is still not clear. Abbott said hospitalizations are the primary metric, but not the only one. Hospitalization rates will tell you what share of the people in Texas hospitals, by district, are coronavirus patients. But the governor's new standard is a lagging indicator of COVID-19 cases. Epidemiologists say it takes 9 to 16 days to see increases in infections from social interactions, and another 5 to 7 days to see changes in the number of people hospitalized. That means someone infected at a particular social gathering might not show up at the hospital for 2 to 3 weeks. The hospitalization number misses a lot about how things are going. It won't tell you how many people have died and whether deaths are rising or falling. It won't reveal the spread of the virus, whether case numbers are going up or down, and it won't provide any information about how many infected Texans have symptoms and how many are asymptomatic. It doesn't tell you anything about how a patient contracted the disease. One piece of news got buried in state leaders' conversation about metrics and reopenings, and that's because they didn't say it directly. This amounts to a declaration that June's coronavirus numbers aren't as scary as they seemed in June, when attention was more on the rising numbers than on the numbers themselves. After a summer spike in the coronavirus in Texas that followed Abbott's first round of reopenings, whether you measure that by positivity rates, hospitalizations, deaths, or something else, state leaders have adopted June numbers that revealed that surge as normal enough to justify more social activity. The trends are encouraging. Just look at the Texas Tribune's coronavirus tracker. On Wednesday, the number of people hospitalized for COVID-19 was down 355 from the previous week to a number not seen since mid-June, and 5.5% of occupied hospital beds were being used by people with the virus at June levels and down from a high of almost 20%. Those are less ghastly numbers than the July and August tallies, but that's no consolation to the Texans wrestling with the virus or at risk of being infected. The trends might even be reason for optimism, but not too much. Abbott was emphatic about the continuing need for masks, social distancing, and hand washing. But with those numbers on the status board, state officials have set their acceptable level of ongoing damage from the pandemic. The numbers of new case counts, hospitalizations, and deaths that justify looser restrictions on people getting together in large groups for business and commerce, sporting events, and in-person public and higher education. Watch the hospitals. In 2 or 3 weeks, we'll know how this new standard is working out. This is Ross Ramsey from the Texas Tribune. Today's column, COVID-19's almost incomprehensible toll in Texas. As of Thursday, COVID-19 had killed 14,590 Texans. That's the official number. Experts tell us the actual number is higher, and the number of COVID-19-related deaths, deaths that aren't attributed to the virus but that wouldn't have occurred without it, is higher still. Some of the televised awards shows, the Academy Awards, for example, feature an in memoriam segment that notes the deaths of people who have passed during the last year. They do it in sports leagues, in college alumni magazines, and in civic clubs. But states don't do it. It's more common to hear the names of businesses closed by the pandemic than the names of humans killed by COVID-19. If you were to read those 14,590 names at the rate of one name per second, it would take more than 4 hours to remember those dead Texans. Even those 1 second mentions would make for a long memorial service, and reciting that many names would still fall far short of making a loss of this size comprehensible. But saying their names would give the dead more notice and more respect than the steady increase in nameless numbers that marked the terrible advance of the coronavirus in Texas. Governor Greg Abbott is leading Texans to venture out into a new round of reopenings of schools, colleges, football games, and now, based on the decreasing number of COVID-19 hospitalizations, allowing increasingly large crowds in restaurants, stores, and office buildings. It's a reasonable time to remember what has happened so far. Mark the moment. This could be where the tide turns in our favor or another plateau that precedes a new surge in the pandemic. There is still no vaccine and no assurance that one will be widely available within the next few months. It's not time to take off that mask. The 2020 World Series will be played in Arlington this year, but with somewhat less than a full house of baseball-loving Texans. Crowds are allowed in some places, but a lot of weddings and birthday celebrations have gone online. Funerals are often conducted online if they're held at all. It's common to end an obituary with an announcement of a memorial at an unspecified future date, a necessary accommodation to the virus that robs family and friends of closure and community, the comfort and remembrance that softens the end of a loved one's life. One can call this no worse than a flu, as if that means anything. Flus are among the deadliest of diseases. The real point is that a new bug, a novel coronavirus, is killing people who would otherwise be alive and making many hundreds of thousands more very, very sick. Stop and think about the human cost of the coronavirus, the human lives lost so far, and with the disease still rampant, the lives yet to be lost in Texas and beyond its borders. Some of us will be attending a large number of get-togethers to remember the friends and family we've lost and pay tribute to them whenever it's safe to get out and do that. You don't hear leaders talking much about the deaths. There's often a passing reference at the start of a news conference or a speech where the pandemic is a subject, but you don't see plans in Texas for a public remembrance of the people who are not with us anymore because of this pandemic. The official responses to the pandemic have been primarily about the disease itself, its effect on the economy, and the balance of government actions and individual freedoms. But this isn't just an economic exercise, or a public health exercise, or a test of government impositions on personal rights. We've lost a lot of Texans already and will surely lose more to the coronavirus. Doesn't it seem like there should at least be a moment of silence?
Now here are a few stories from NPR. Our first is, a former Surgeon General discusses public mistrust of health officials.
The United States continues to be the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic. The Trump administration has been beset by scandals on its handling of the health crisis, and the president habitually and publicly contradicts his own officials on how to deal with the deadly disease. A new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll shows that a majority of Americans disapprove of the job the president is doing handling the outbreak. Joining us now is Dr. Vivek Murthy. He served as the Surgeon General under President Obama, followed by President Trump until 2017. He is now advising Democratic nominee for the presidency, Joe Biden, on the pandemic. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Lulu. It's good to be with you.
You worked for the Trump administration briefly. What has gone wrong in your view?
The response to COVID-19, which should be driven by science and evidence, has instead been overtaken by politics. And that's muddied the waters, both in terms of the actions that we take, but also in terms of the trust that we need to maintain with the public.
I mean, definitely the NPR polling shows that. The public has been given this consistently confusing messaging. Just this past week, President Trump disputed his own CDC director, Robert Redfield, on the efficacy of masks and on when a vaccine will be available. And our poll shows that people are listening to the president, and there is a lack of faith, as you say, in public health leadership and institutions. There have been multiple stories at the CDC and elsewhere in the public health sphere. It's buckling to political pressure and intervention. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think what has been happening is that the input and the recommendations of scientists at CDC and elsewhere in government have been overridden. Most recently, in the recommendations that the CDC supposedly had made, a change in recommendations saying that it was no longer necessary to test people who were contacts of those who had COVID-19 if they didn't have symptoms. That was widely criticized by the scientific community, and now we understand why. Because it wasn't actually the decision of CDC scientists to put that guidance forward. In fact, it was the exact opposite of what they had recommended, and we now see that guidance has been changed.
You know the players here in the public health sphere. Do you think it is incumbent upon these leaders to speak out when this happens?
We have seen at times people like Tony Fauci and Dr. Redfield stood up and made important points about masks that have been then contradicted by the president. And the challenge is that we need more people to be doing that, and we need people to be doing that more consistently. This is a very unusual situation where we have seen a divergence, a sustained and disturbing divergence between what scientists are saying and what politicians are saying. And that is extraordinarily destructive.
So how do you suggest the course could be changed? You are advising the Biden campaign. What are you telling them?
When you start to put politics ahead of science, that's when you spell the end of a truly effective response. So it starts number one.
But isn't that cat out of the bag already, though? I mean, on the Republican side, the coronavirus isn't their top concern for this election. But to get out of this, we need a majority of Americans to row together. I mean, how do you actually do that now when the trust, as you say, has been eroded?
You have to rebuild that trust. And the way that you rebuild trust is you communicate openly and honestly with the public, not just when things are going well, but especially when they're not. And you inspire trust by delivering on your promises. If you say that you're going to make testing available, then you got to make sure that testing is actually available. If you say that you're going to ensure that doctors and nurses and hospitals have protective equipment like masks, you have to deliver on those promises. Yes, there has been a lot of damage to public trust, but that does not mean that it cannot be repaired. And it will take a sustained effort to communicate openly and honestly with the public, but it can be done and it must be done.
Our poll, though, also shows the number of Americans who say they'll get the vaccine has dropped sharply in just a month. Only 49% say that they'll get vaccinated when a vaccine is made available. Last month, it was 60%. I mean, a vaccine won't end this, but it will be a major step. That is a very troubling statistic.
This number of people who are worried about a vaccine being rushed through and approved before the election includes many healthcare professionals that I talked to as well, who behind closed doors say they're not sure if they would want to take a vaccine if they felt it was rushed through without proper consideration. And so what we have to do, and even more so than ever, is make sure that the approval process for a vaccine is transparent. And that means that we have to have sufficient data from large-scale trials to demonstrate this vaccine is both safe and effective. It means that the FDA's scientists and its external advisory board have to weigh in publicly and share their opinion directly with the public. If these seem like measures that are extraordinary, it's because we are in an unusual time where we have damaged trust so badly that we have to go over and above to regain that trust. Otherwise, people will not trust the vaccine, even if it's approved.
That's Dr. Vivek Murthy, former Surgeon General. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Lulu.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Monday, September 21st, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Here's what's coming up today on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. At 2 o'clock, national news from USA Today. Following that at 3, we'll be reading local articles from the papers. Here are some of those stories our volunteers will be reading from Saturday, Sunday, and Monday's papers. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Midland unemployment continues its decline. Crude prices again are above $40 a barrel. New interim superintendent seeks answers. Local jobless rate falls to 8.1%. And from the Odessa American, Black Chamber of Commerce of the Permian Basin hosts City Candidate Forum. Orthopedic surgeons back in business. Three teens dead in fatal crash. Those articles and more at 3 o'clock today. And then at 6 o'clock, we'll bring you more news from the Wall Street Journal. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
Watering schedule. The City of Midland has adjusted the lawn and landscaping watering schedule, which will allow residents to water 4 days a week instead of two. Even-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and odd-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
If you're a do-it-yourselfer, don't let physical challenges limit your imagination. Each week, the guys on The Blind Handyman answer questions and offer tips on home maintenance and upgrades.
As we've pointed out several times, you do things when you're blind. Many times you do them the same way a sighted person would. A drill is a drill is a drill. A saw is a saw. And you just need to remember, don't get your fingers in it and push the board through it.
You want to make sure that your structure